In this segment of the IRWE project to record some of the history of radio and electronics in South Australia, I'm speaking today to Mr. Ted McGrath. Welcome, Ted. I wonder if you might be able to start by giving us an idea how you perhaps first became interested in radio, how you got into the industry.
Yes, Ian, I was working in the post office in the what was then the newly formed transmission section, who was given the responsibility for the National Broadcasting Service. And in September 1930, I went down to work at the studios and the transmitters, or transmitter, if RCL was the only transmitter. And I was one of the early bunch of PMG technicians that were employed on this new service.
How did you actually get involved in the... How did you come to get into radio communications, or was it telephony, or what?
The transmission section was a development of ordinary telephone work. It was long line equipment, and it was included in those days. When I first joined them, they got their first carrier telephone and telegraph systems, and they included their valves and oscillators and filters, and that was my first introduction.
Yeah, so you went straight into PMG from school?
No, I'd done a 5-year general engineering apprenticeship course before I joined the post office in 1926 as a mechanic putting in telephones.
Where did you do that here?
In Adelaide, yes, and mostly in the Prospect District. But I came up here to Stirling in 1927, and I was employed up here for a year before I went back to the city.
Was that course run by PMG?
No, that wasn't a course. You were just chucked to the wolves, in effect. But I was very, very fortunate that I... putting in telephones, I was allocated to a senior... technician, not a senior technician, but a technician who was senior. And I was very, very fortunate, and the two men I was attached to who were very kind, very helpful, and gave me just the right start. The game was entirely new to me then. All I'd done is before that was to put in a few front doorbells.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, perhaps we'll get back to the radio bit then.
When we took over Brooklyn Park from the company, Radio Inspectors Branch took it over in January, I think, of 1930. And they ran it with a fair number of the ex-employees of the commercial company. But it was a bit of a big job for the Radio Inspectors Branch. They didn't have the staff nor the facilities, and throughout the Commonwealth then it was handed over to the Engineering Division, and that's how the transmission section in all states actually took over the running of what was to be the National Broadcasting Service.
And were there other stations owned by other companies, or was this the only one at that time?
I think 5DN was going. 5KA, I'm not sure about that one.
Yes, they were going.
Yes.
But, 5AD didn't start?
No, they hadn't started then, because Don Gooding left 5CL and started
5AD, that's right.
Well, I don't know whether he started there. Who else? Somebody else with him. Was it Ted Ashwin, I think, was it?
Yes.
Ted Ashwin. But 5AD came later. But I think the other two stations were going then. But the equipment was in a pretty bad condition, as you might imagine. Mm-hmm. One of the first jobs we had to do was to keep it on the air and then make changes to it. So limb and life was not threatened. Like at Brooklyn Park, for instance, when you went in the front door, the lead... the 15,000 volt lead for the mod amp went up a bare wire on the wall of the standoff insulator and over the ceiling and dropped into the cage, and there was absolutely no protective equipment around it whatsoever.
This was 5CL.
5CL, yes.
And was it called 5CL when they took it over?
Yes, it was 5CL when it was taken over, and it was down at Brooklyn Park then. And that was accepted practice in those days. It was reckoned that if you were a qualified radio technician, that you'd know that there was 15,000 volts on that lead and you just didn't touch it. It was just as simple as that. But, it took quite a while to change it, and we made, I suppose, the water-cooled valves in the final stage were as an area where we had to do a lot of work there, because although the company had put them in, they hadn't really got them going properly. Incidentally, in those days, the filaments of the final tubes were all run by motor generators. The bias came from a motor generator. And it was not at all unusual to finish a session down there, and they didn't run anything like the hours they run now. The segments in the day were, I think it was 7 o'clock to 8:30, and they came on again at about 11, I think, and ran to 2, and 3 to 4, and then they came on after 5 and ran through to about 11 at night. So they were not very long sessions, you had a nice break for maintenance in between. But at Brooklyn Park, in the very early days, you sometimes finish up a session with a wooden stick in your hand holding the brushes of either the bias generator or the filament generator, because it was arcing that badly and things were just starting to go haywire. And the filament generator, by the way, the brushes there were of the plaited copper type. You don't see them around today, mostly today, and there were a lot then, were carbon composition brushes. But these were a sort of a plaited copper thing, and only running for, the 11 hours, 6 hours at night, long tails would form on the copper, and they would now short over two or three segments of the commutator, and the drops off in voltages and arcs and sparks going on.
What would have been the power input to the transmitter in those times?
Nobody knows.
Like it's 50 kilowatts now, it would have been 10 kilowatts, do you think? Or?
I think it was supposed to be about 5.
I think the licence was for 5, but whether it made that, nobody's too sure.
Well, here again, the meter that read the aerial currents, and I don't know who read the aerial impedance, but the meter that read the aerial current was a hot wire instrument, and it wasn't compensated, which means that when it was switched off, it was still reading. On a hot day, it was still reading up the scar, but the operators had learnt from practice that it went to a certain point and there it was.
That must have been the right spot.
And the radio inspector in those days didn't measure your frequency, he measured your wavelength. And he had rather a broad meter there in which he would look on the dial for about the same, if you were somewhere in it, I don't know, seemed to be about 10 divisions either side, well, you're okay, because there weren't that many stations around in those days anyhow. And so long as the listeners could tune you on the dial, that seemed to be the thing that mattered.
And there wouldn't have been a problem from interstate either in those times, would there?
Although, strangely enough, if you looked around the country, and we struck this when we went to 5CK, and there were a lot here. In fact, on the railway line between Only Park and Millswood for years, there was original home installation of 200-foot pipe mast, it'd be about 150 feet apart, and this was their receiving aerial. So people were getting some long-distance reception in those days, but there was nobody. Our frequency wasn't reallocated anywhere else in the Commonwealth, as far as I know, in those days. So there was no common channel interference with it. But the rectifier valves down at Brooklyn Park were air-cooled valves. There were 6 of them in a full-wave rectifier, and they gave off an enormous amount of heat. They were, I've forgotten the figure now, but many kilowatts of heat from the filament. And of a hot night, the operator down there would usually be sitting with his feet in the back of the water to try and keep himself cool, because the atmosphere in there was very, 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 very hot indeed. But Well, the master oscillator down there was a Meissner type. It wasn't crystal control. It wasn't crystal control for quite a long while down there. And if you shut the back door or the front door with a slam, you're likely to change the frequency a bit, because the coils were mounted on the top of this. They were in individual cages in those days. An RCA pattern that AWA had followed, and these coils are up on the top, and shut the door, and there'd be a little bit of a wobble, and the frequency would jump. It'd just settle down again, I suppose, fairly quickly.
But my recollection of a Meissner circuit was there were three sets of coils,
wasn't there? Right. Three sets of coils.
Yeah. Well, how did we develop from those early days? What
well,
happened
it, actually, it was now a matter of making changes, and this is the thing that I was originally on the operating work, but I came off that and work now on the changes and installation work there under Frank A. Brady. Laurie Billen was an early, very, very active, very capable radio engineer, but unfortunately he died in 1939, and I took over from him actually when I qualified. But he worked very hard, and I worked with him in the very early days, changing. See, we had to change the studio and the transmitter because the studios were remarkably reliable. And
the studio wasn't at Brooklyn Park, though.
No, that was in Hindmarsh Square.
Yes,
in Hindmarsh Square then, and it was there were two studios then. There was the big one, and then there was a little one out the back for talks and things like that. The acoustics were mostly flags and curtains and things hung down on the studio. And the old lightning, the thunder agitator, remember the great big long sheet that somebody had shaped?
That's right.
And it was pretty haywire. The microphones then were condenser type microphones. And they had the great habit too, just that you could test them before the session started. And you could switch them on and bingo, they'd gone, and something had got across the very narrow gap in the condenser microphone, 130 volts across it. Now, that was another thing. The studios were fed, a lot of the stuff there were fed by batteries, which had to be charged, of course, overnight. And there wasn't a spare set of batteries in those days, which we pretty quickly remedied by temporarily putting in a spare set of batteries. But it was pretty dicey. Some mornings you'd come in there, and what happened in those days, and I suppose I can say this now, was that the staff, the technical staff whom they'd replaced, knew they were going to lose their job, and then they lost them, and a lot of the studio staff were in sympathy with them. And they did many things to make it difficult for us. We come in the morning and find the battery flat because somebody purposely, after we'd left, turned the switch on and the batteries had gone down. Or worse than that, they used to have rebels for the night there. After the station closed, they all had keys to it, and they'd come in and have a real hop-up party. They're using the studio equipment for, you know, loudspeaker work and things like that. So that for a while there, we had a fair amount of difficulty in a way in settling in, but we had a good lead, and that was the main thing. And it wasn't long before we started to lick it into shape. The big changes came a bit later on, though, when the studios were changed over to all AC operation. And that was a first for Australia, and we did believe for the world. Like Frank O'Grady had got under an article on a new valve that was available in the 77. And we set up in the laboratory there a whole prototype of what the studio chain would be like. And this was very encouraging. The noise levels were very good. Distortion was good. But you must remember, we didn't have the equipment we've got today. And that, in the early days, I think, of broadcasting, this was a thing where we didn't really know the sort of quality we were putting out. We couldn't measure it. When we did get measuring equipment, they only measured one frequency, 400 cycles. And that was the only one we could measure it at. We had an oscilloscope in our early days, and I think this was the only one in Adelaide. Anybody remember the 1936 Conversazione?
That's right.
We put it in there
with
some oscillators, and everybody was amazed. They'd never seen an oscilloscope before.
Gee. I didn't know that the post office had so much test equipment.
As a matter of fact, in those days, the post office was the organisation that you looked to for this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Even the university, old Kirk Grant, came to us. He had a very, very close relationship with Frank O'Grady, and a lot of mutual help between the two of them. But we had, primitive as it was by present standards, we had the only equipment that could measure a lot of these things. But anyhow, this prototype was so successful that it was decided that we would go ahead, which we did. But by the time we got into production, the 77 valve had disappeared. They weren't making any more. And by the way, they were for mobile use. Entertainment. Yeah. Broadcast entertainment sets in mobiles. The 77 and the 89. And they were the two valves worked on there. The 66 took its place, but it wasn't quite as good, but it was still very good, really. And that was the basis of the new studio equipment, and we used, for the first time that I'd struck it anyhow, a voltage doubler rectifiers to provide the power for the racks of equipment. And we turfed out the condenser microphones and went for those old brown SDCs. I've forgotten what the name is now. You might know it.
402 something or other, 4021 I think.
The brown ones, and also the plugs, where they plugged into the wall. The company had a range of plugs there that were always giving trouble, and we went now for those clamp types. It was an STC thing, we pushed them in, they clamped in tightly. And all these things now improved the reliability of the service, really.
Yeah.
And the big studio at Hindmarsh Square, in the not in the church building, but in the original. That was redesigned by a mechanical engineer, Bridgeland, who just finished his degree and was going in for acoustics, which was a new thing in 1935. There weren't too many of them around. And he and the architect got together with us, and that studio, what was it called, 500, I think, wasn't it?
The larger one was 510 later but it was Studio 1 first of all.
Yes, and Studio 2 was the one out the back again. That didn't get the same acoustic treatment, but all the flags and things came down now, and that 510, as you call it, Studio 1, that was a very good studio, but a bit small.
Wasn't that one of the first that had the live-end, dead-end technique?
Yes, this fellow Bridgeland had studied all this, and He came up with that. Of course, Frank O'Grady knew all this live-in, dead-in stuff too, so they worked together as a very good team there. But I did a lot of early tests after the studio was finished, and it was surprising of a night time. You know that thing the tramways used to have that used to go around grinding the rails at 2 o'clock in the morning? Well, when that thing, we had a few sensitive meters then, and we were measuring noise on it, and you could start to get funny readings on your meters, and just that tram going along the line there, the feel it put out was sufficient to get them into the studio and actuate these meters. In fact, remember when the Healings were on the northeast, southeast side of Pulteney Street there?
Southwest.
They're on the other side first.
Oh, yeah.
Early on, and then they went to that one. I was walking down to the studios one morning, looking in the window at this array of meters, and all of a sudden I see them. Well, I suppose they were volt meters, I don't know. And then there's a tram coming up Wentzel Street. Later on, about 10 minutes later, one came down Pulteney Street, well, they all went off scale.
Were they connected up inside?
No, just the DC field, you see, from the trams. See, they had 600 volts on the overhead wires, I think, in those days. And it was all DC and the field as they came down. When they got to another section where there was a different feeder, you'd see the thing drop or increase. And stuff. But that's only just by the way. Anyhow, that put the studios pretty right for those things, but the Brooklyn Park itself, there's a lot of experiments were made down there to try and get more power from them. Originally, I understand that we were to have, 5CL were to have two masts down there, and they reached to be that 210, I think they were. They're going to be two of those with aerial stuck between them. But because of financial problems, the same company, I think, was interested in 3LO. They took one of the masts for 3LO, and only one came here. And the aerial, it was just a sloping aerial that came down to a counterpoise about 15, 20 feet above the ground at the other end of the paddock. And that's what we had was this thing, which was a rather directional, of course, and had very high voltages on it when it came through the roof of the building. Mm. And we played around with that for some time to try and correct it, but we tried shunt feeding the aerial, but the mast was too short to be successful. Well, eventually during the war, we jacked it up onto a spider and then fitted it at the bottom now with a 6-wire transmission line, and that's the way that finished there. But in the meantime, 5CK had got going. That was in 1900.
And you were in on the start of that,
weren't
you?
Yes, I went up to 5CK. I wasn't the first to go there. Bill Wisson had gone up with Chris Camus, and Laurie Billen had been up there, but I went up there in June 1931. And this was the same station as they put in at Corowa. It was an STC 7.5 kilowatt we bought that for. And they had all the latest things. They had crystal control for a start, which we didn't have, and a great big oven in there that take four or five crystals. Incidentally, when CK started, again, allocations were made on the basis of wavelength, not frequency. That was 635 kc then when we started. It became 640 later on when they got these even multiples of 10. And we worked up there and put it in. The original staff putting it in there was Bill Wisson in charge of it. Chris Camus, Jock Anders, Len Cooper and myself. Len Cooper he came up towards the end. He came up near the opening. And you remember George Ramsey? Not George Ramsey the engineer, but George Ramsey in the department?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He came up there as a metal basher because there was a lot of metal work, pipe screwing and things to do for the cooling of the valves and the engine, things like this, and he came up there too. And it's interesting, and when you think back to that in those days, of all the racks that were in 5CK, and all the equipment was mounted on series of racks side by side, mostly with a front and then an angled support going back to the back of them. They weren't filled in completely. They were all bolted. There wasn't a weld anywhere in them. And this was the thing that, and when we were doing such things, I worked with George Ramsey on two or three projects there, and when we had to make up frames and things, you drilled holes and you either riveted them or you bolted them, so that you were drilling holes sometimes with those belly busters, you know, with a ratchet thing on the hand thing, and when you stop to think of it now, but we had no electric drills. By the way,
they don't even use a hand screwdriver these days. They've got these power screwdrivers.
Yes, I do that too. But 5CK had a number of features. All their minor voltages, and when I say minor for the station, up to 4,000 volts was supplied by generators. There was no rectifiers for the earlier stages. The studio equipment was batteries, two sets of batteries, and that went up to 300 volts. There, 360 was it? And but these matter generator sets, there were three of them in each group, and the standby set too. And that gave the 24 volts, 22, 24 volts for the filament, about 150, 160 for the bias. And then there was a 3,000 and a 1,500 on separate machines. And they connected them in series to get the 4,000 they wanted for one thing. Now, I can't remember now, and I must have done it, how we used to service those commutators, because even with the field switched off, there's still a fair amount of kick in those things, but I can't remember. Perhaps we wore special gloves or something, but commutators have to be attended to, and that was always an important part of those earlier installations.
The brushes used to wear them out.
Yeah, the brushes wear out, and what's more, you'd start to get some sort of contamination on the armature itself, and you'd just have to clean them. But, there they were, and the board itself, the switchboard all halfway along the wall, the open-bladed switch, there were 4,000 volts on, you go from one machine to the other. Slippery like rhino on the floor, you could skide into them, but nobody ever did it. And again, the theory was, well, you were qualified men, and you should know that you just don't go near those things. And,
were there standby generators, generators for
This is standby. What for?
Well, as an emergency, if you lost a generator due to something going on.
Well, you'd switch over to the other set. In that case, if any of the generator sets went out, you'd switch over a complete set and then work on the faulty one. Was the usual thing. But we had a standby mains supply.
Yeah, like there. A diesel sort of thing.
Yes. Well, it was petrol in those days, and well, lovely. All the thing had was a bowl with one needle in it, and none of this adjusting of half a dozen different attachments on them. But it started from compressed air, and you had to turn, it had one of those impulse magnetos on it, and you had to key this around into the right starting position for that, switch on the air, which I think was fed into two of the six cylinders. They didn't get any petrol for a while, and this great big bottle that held the compressed air went up the wall of the building, and many a time you were just down, I reckon, to the point where you had no air left when the thing would finally fire. And the stuff that we had in those days, compressors weren't as freely available as they are now, take you half an hour to 40 minutes to fill up the bottle again. Of course, once it started, automatically, its own little compressor would now charge it up, but it didn't matter if that took half a day, in theory. And so that was the standby for that one.
Was there any facility for that to come on automatically if you had a failure, or did that have to be manually operated?
No, it had to be done manually.
Yeah.
There was a bit of a problem at 5CK. The mains power feed for the town was the ordinary country town installation. Though Crystal Brook had a pretty bright fellow there running the town supply. But round about, 9 o'clock at night, they'd switch over to a single lunger, and, you know, you could see the lights. It was quite unsatisfactory for what we wanted. I suppose in those days we would have been taking about 20, 25 kilowatts from the station, as a guess. And the local council wouldn't, so they'd given a franchise to this chap, which had some time to run, and he wouldn't let them allow Etcher to come in, because I suppose you could see once they got into the district, he'd lose the township. And so they had a bit of a skullduggery there. They brought it down from Gladstone to the boundary of Gladstone and Crystal Brook. And then they ran it through, they got an easement from a private landowner, in fact, the chap from whom the 5CK station property was bought. The other day over his land, so it was not on public road. It ran through this property, and it was then a form of a private line or something into our station. That caused a lot of minor problems in the beginning, and we used to have a barb or two shot at us as we walk around the town about with a holding progress, because I think the people in Crystal Brook could see that if the local power supply supplied the station, they'd get a better supply. But see, in those days there were no refrigerators really around the country in 1930. I don't know of any in Crystal Brook. There might have been. There weren't any big electric heaters of any sort, no washing machines, and there was a night time.
Using it for power and...
Well, no, for lights, and perhaps a toaster or two or something like that.
And the ironing for clothes.
Yes, do that. Well, in fact, in some towns, by the way, in those days, the ironing was a special day because the bloke would make sure he had the big machine. However, that was the beginning of... that was the beginning of 5CK, yes, and the power supply coming from ETSA.
When did Mid-North supply power there? Did they come into the picture at any time?
Not in my memory, no. It was only... they never came into it. ETSA, by the way, were through the Gladstone pretty early. They had a lot of... Did they take it? Well, I can remember very early on ETSA's line going up at least to Gladstone, the Maglins then. But we used the engine then for running regular sessions if ETSA's power was cut off for any reason.
Could we come back to 5CL? How long was that in Brooklyn Park?
It stayed there until West Beach became the airport spot. And we had a big property, a big area of land down there. In the war years, about 1944, I think, when the authorities were getting frightened about the chance of Adelaide being bombed or something like that, they decided that the 5AN tower, which was on the top of Commonwealth buildings in Commonwealth Place, was a pretty fair target and ought to be removed. And the 5AN transmitter, which went in 1937, was in an annex of the old central telephone exchange there, and it just fed out up to this thing. So we had the job now of moving it down to Brooklyn Park, and we did that during the war years. And that was about a 180-foot tower, I think, that one. And that was now a tower. It wasn't a guide mast. And that was put in one corner of the block. But at that time, we were starting to get little niggles that, West Beach might go ahead. But what we had to do when we moved the AN down there, we had to now put up another building. And we copied the original CL building. And incidentally, that was very interesting for insulation and that. They had sand. Mm-hmm. They had asbestos sheets on the outside and asbestos sheets on the inside and the sand in between. If you drill the hole or put anything in, you've got three or four buckets of sand every time from it. But we didn't put sand in ours. We put fiberglass was becoming about then, and we used that there. But we had to put this building there, put AN there. Well then, after the war, I don't know the exact timing of that one, but it was obvious now that the airport was going to go there and they'd want a road through it. In the meantime, the local Boy Scouts had put pressure on I won't mention his name, the local member down in that area in the federal parliament, and we'd agreed to them having an area of the land for their scout troop hall. And, we were starting to get hemmed in a bit then. In 1946, I started on a program of selecting sites for a new 5CL, 5AN. You couldn't go north very much because the thing you wanted was a powerful transmitter, which would be at least 10 kilowatts, eventually 50. If you went north, you're getting too much into Elizabeth saws being cut smaller, and what's more, you are cutting now into 5 CKs area.
Yeah, yes.
So south was the way to go, and there was plenty of land down then. There was only a few dairies and that, and the first choice was Pimpala, where it is. But we looked at about 6 or 7 sites, Hoella and Hill, Kangarilla, Mount Barker, Manon. We went all around and did a very, very detailed survey, field intensity survey. You set up a transmitter, a small transmitter, and you went out and measured the thing around. And it all came back always to Pimpala was the best spot. For a number of reasons, once you leave Arala and Hill, you've got all gullies and things there until you get to Pimpala. But if you go any further down than Pimpala, you're getting into the shadow of the hills down the bottom end there near Ratford's Rapid Bay and those areas there. But it wasn't to be. You know, nobody would sell us any land. We wanted 50 acres for there. The sections then were 80 acres from memory. Nobody would sell any land at all. They wouldn't sell it. But the block that we chose, that's the present block, belonged to a fellow whose forebears had come out with some of the first immigrants here. And he was a locksmith by trade, and he'd done a good turn, so he's descendant told me, he'd done a good turn to the government of the day. He'd lost the key to the treasury safe. He couldn't open the safe and they couldn't get any money to pay anything. And he went down there and fixed us up for them. And he was either given the option to buy a large area of land or else he was given the land, I don't know which. And he held the land right from the seacoast, right up, I suppose, to about where South Road is now, right through there. But over the years it had been gradually whittled away, but this fellow had this one section of 80 acres. He was he worked in the railways, South Australian Railways. His job was to test the brakes on freight trains before they went out to make sure they were all working. And he opposed it, but he picked on me now. And every Sunday for weeks, went on for years actually, when he was off duty, he'd ride up to my home and I'd spend pretty well 4 or 5 hours going over the same things. He didn't want to sell this land, and you know, it was a shame to do it to him. It had been in the family for so long and such like. And I was very careful not to offend him in any way, and I missed quite a few meals, by the way, listening to him. I never invited him in for a meal. Bit inhospitable, isn't it? But however, his son was the secretary of a local political party, federal political party, up near Brisbane. And he was very, very friendly with a very prominent member of the cabinet, federal cabinet. He belonged to the same branch as the son did. And he pitched the tale to this fella about the rough treatment he was getting by these young squirts down in Adelaide who were pushing his father around and giving him no peace and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which was far from the truth, of course. But the government at the time was a coalition government, and they were dead against any compulsory acquisition. If people would give it up, okay. Yeah. If they wouldn't, well, you couldn't have it. Well, what did it take? It was 1946. It was 1960 before 5AN and 5CL were really transferred down there. It kept being referred back to us. In the meantime, the Broadcasting Control Board had been formed. Now, they came into it now because this site selection was one of their functions from then on. It had been ours up until then. They went over it, and that they all came to the same conclusion again. We had to hire an independent authority, who was Don Gooding. He came out and looked at them, went all over it with us. He came back to the same conclusion.
the conclusion that it was the best
spot. Yes, the best spot. Mm. It was a properly chosen spot, and I was quite confident that if it was chosen on technical merits, well, there was no doubt that's where it would go. But when politics come into it, it's a bit different. Mm. Well, we thought we had it all set up and, everything okay. When the Housing Trust announced they were going to have a major development down the south, and they were writing to the department to tell them, just in case they thought there might be some trouble from the sighting of the transmitter at Pimpala. Well, it was all on again. 4 times, I think, we went round and did all these measurements, and they took a long time. Mm. But, however, in the end, it went ahead. Then suddenly, we see now the people who wouldn't sell us land were selling it to the Housing Trust. And, however,
politics and money
got down there. Mm. But getting back to 5CK, when that station was put up, the aerial up there was a flat top, and what was known as an Alexanderson multi-feed aerial. It had 3 downleads on it. The standard one was fit. And it was quite a construction, this, and a very, very active, very intelligent local lineman and myself were given the job of constructing this aerial, which was 6 wires with a Norwegian first spreaders, great big insulators, and they came under these down leads, and they all joined together, of course, came down with 4 of these wires with separators on them. And the wire was a special phosphor bronze, was it? It was a special wire that was sent out from England. It wasn't a hard-drawn copper or anything like that. It was just special, I think it was phosphor bronze. And there were two tuning huts, already cast in position besides the towers at each end. But the huts and the centre lead were fairly critical, especially the huts. They were there, they were cast into the ground, out of the concrete. The centre lead you might have been able to alter. And we worked on this thing and built it up very carefully and measured it out, checked our measurements. And the big day came for hauling it up, and we had an engineer, an installation engineer from STC, he'd come from New Zealand. He was an Englishman. He was sort of directing PMG staff who did all the actual work under his guidance. And he'd told the local paper that, at 2 o'clock on this day, this area was going to be hauled up. And in fact, I think he had something he was hanging on it. But, the press from Piri was going to be over there. Just before we went to lunch on the day, Bill Wilson, who was in charge, we said to him, better check it again. And he came out and we checked it all over. And Bill had a little wry sense of humour. He said, it's okay, except you're 4 feet short. And we said, here, we'll come and have a look. Sure enough, this thing's 4 feet short. I looked at this line and your heart was in your boots because what were you going to do about this? You couldn't move the huts. And this English bloke was telling us so often, had it hang down and how nice it would look and everything else. So we went home to lunch, feeling pretty down. I was staying with Bill Wilson and his wife then, and it was a pretty glum lunch as we're trying to work this out. So we go back again and we measure it again. It's okay. Can't believe it. And we dash into the store again. Now, we had 2 tape measures, and one of them must have been returned to the store with 4 feet chopped off it. And somebody had made a wonderful job of folding it over and stapling it down as it was. And as we were measuring long distances, we never looked anywhere near the 4 feet, and we were always looking down to the 100-foot end. But in the end, it was all okay. It came out okay.
You mentioned Frank O'Grady quite a bit. I never knew him, but he must have been a fairly bright.
He was. He later on became the Director General of the Post Office. But he he was the best transmission, the best radio engineer that I knew, and I knew quite a few of them. Mm. There were some good ones in the other states, but I think Frank O'Grady stood out from them. And he was a great boss to work for. I never knew in all the years I was with him for him ever to berate me for anything. If anything was done wrong, I imagine I must have done something, as that he rather would have done a different way. It wasn't his manner to do that. I remember in the early days of Five Seal, when we took it over, there was a heap of rubbish down there, and they had their water-cooled tubes in sort of wooden mounts, and above them was a sort of a half shelf, and on that shelf were the old records of the station. And we were finishing a job one night down there, and Frank said, "Oh, go and get those old records, I just want to have a look through them." I went in there and got one, and the whole lot fell down and broke the top off one of these water-cooled valves. And they were then about $200 or £200 or something. And I came out with a sheepish look, face with a book in one hand and this and the other. He didn't say a word, he just did a smile and he said, "Oh." But he told me later on, when I worked much more closely with him, that the then director wanted to sack me. Because he had to order another tube, and he had to show how the other one had been accidentally broken. And the then director of the day, you remember E.P. Ramsey?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, oh, yes, he was out there. But eventually Frank convinced him that it was a straight accident. Well, then he said, "All right, well, in that case, we'll take it out of his pay." Well, you know, just the depression years were on then, and what was I on, about £5 a week or something? £200 or £150 or something for this valve. Mm. But that's the sort of fellow that he was. Yeah.
Where would he have been trained?
Here. He became a... I think he was a telegraph messenger, and then was he put off? He worked for Hunby, Orne and Johnson's as an electrical, mechanic there on installations. Yeah, Frank O'Grady worked for Hunby, Orne and Johnson's as an installation mechanic. In fact, he told me one interesting thing. Do either of you remember the old exhibition building, mm-hmm. North Terrace? And you remember that he used to have a big dame that came over the top, and they had... On a special occasion, they had lights running. Well, he had the job of running those lights down on there, and they didn't have cherry pickers or anything in those days, and he had to put these lights down and have these outlets. And everything. He couldn't buy one of these multi-outlet cables like you do today. He had to make them up. But he was in there, and then he joined the department as a... I think he must have joined, like I did, as a temporary mechanic. He saw an examination for engineer, and he sat for it and passed it. And from then on, he was that bright that he made. He started off as a lines in the lines section for a start, and he used to tell the story that he had a fight to be made an engineer. He'd passed, he'd qualified, and there were quite a few people in acting who were not qualified in any way. And he made a protest about this. And the then head of that particular section, remember Perth Rowe?
Yes.
J.P. Rowe? Mm-hmm. He wrote back in support and said, "This unknown, untried, untrained young engineer wouldn't be able to carry out this work, etc., etc." But Frank didn't see that until he was a lot older. First job he got was at Wakeree, I believe, where a gang were putting in cables down some of the streets there, and they blasted a few holes in windows, and Frank was sent up to placate the owners of the houses. He told me that was about the first time. But however, he went over, he was involved in the early changeover of the system to automatic telephones in Adelaide. He did a lot of work on that. Mm. And he went over to Melbourne, central office there, to help with there, because, as I say, he was pretty bright and they'd waken up to that. And transmission was now becoming established, what was called transmission sections. That's where these carrier systems that were coming in, and the positions were created in each state, and there was one in Adelaide, and a local fellow working locally, engineer working locally, got the job, but he had knew nothing about transmission or radio or anything else. In fact, he was a nice fellow, but you know, he wouldn't set the place alight at all. And when Frank heard of this in Melbourne, he got in touch with this chap and said, "Look, you know, you came from Melbourne originally. What about you and I making a swap? I'd like to go back to Adelaide." And so they did that. But the chief engineer of the day had just gone for a trip to England, and he went on a boat. Of course, they're out of touch for 3 months or something. When he came back and found out Frank O'Grady had changed, he was very hostile. He wanted to alter it all. And, he came over. He stayed in Adelaide, and just as well he did, because he was, as I say, a really champion transmission engineer. And at that time, all states were moving now to a development of long line communications, like trunk lines as they're called, away from the ordinary city stuff, and. Especially with carrier systems coming in, they had special requirements on wire lines, which were their main means of feeding these things around. There were not many cables in, mostly. In fact, on the important lines, there were no entrance cables. The Adelaide-Melbourne routes came right down through Victoria Square and came in. They might have come in a very short special entrance cable near the old Central Exchange, but that was all, and I think the Perth route was a bit like that too, but in those days it was open wire lines, so the open wire lines have to be now upgraded to take these carrier systems, because crosstalk requirements were different, and transpositions on the lines. Well, Frank O'Rady was the man who did that here. As I said, in the other states there are other men, and some of them were very good too, but in my opinion, Frank O'Rady was the champion of them all. Well, he stayed here until, and by the way, his transmission activities covered the transmission, the long line, the radio, broadcasting. They were under his control.
It's a wide range of
but with certain divisions, where he had a divisional engineer looking after each activity, and I eventually became a divisional engineer under him. And he left here in the post office in 1949 and went over to WRE. We were then helping WRE with their communications in connection with the rocket range. He went over there for a while, to about 1957, I think. He came back to the post office in Adelaide for a short time. Then he went to Melbourne as assistant chief engineer, and from there eventually he got the director general's job. And he was responsible for the department introducing the crossbar system, telephone working.
Was he?
Yes. There'd been a lot of discussions about it, whether they would or they wouldn't work something else, and he made the final decision to introduce it. Now, we're up at, we were 5CK, were we then? I told you about the aerial up there. By the way, when it went up, it hung perfectly. We were congratulated upon it all. But 5CK was bought as a 7.5 kilowatt transmitter.
Yes.
And so was Corowa. There were three transmitters bought. Corowa, the same as 5CK, and 2NC Newcastle, which I think was 2.5 kilowatts. But that was not really much like the ones, the equipment that we got here. We believed it was 7.5 because we put 10 amps up the aerial stick, the dummy load, which was composition carbon resistors, measured 7.5 ohms, so 10 times 10 times 7.5 is 7.5 kilowatts. But research after CK went in, looking now, or the department was looking for a transmitter for 6WF in Perth to replace that one. And they apparently didn't have the money to buy another one, but research built 6WF Perth. And they couldn't get 7.5 kilowatts from it. And after a lot of measurements and things, and now, by the way, they were getting more reliable instruments to measure things, they found what seemed to be so obvious, I wonder it wasn't found before, that when you've got carbon in anything, the temperature coefficient is such that the resistance drops when it heats up. And when you put 7.5 kilowatts or whatever into the dummy load, its resistance was really only about 62.5. And that was really the succeeding transmitters that were bought from STC were now rated at 6.25. There was no more talk of 7.5. So almost overnight, as it were, we dropped down from 7.5 to 6.25.
Yeah, they eventually went to measuring the DC input power, didn't they, the means of
determining. Incidentally, on 5CK, I mentioned earlier that they had these motor generators supplying all these voltages around the place, and when you came into the mod amp stage and the early RF stages, you had one feed into there, a 1500 volt feed through umpteen decoupling and dropping resistors. So if anything happened to a component or a valve, everything in about five or six stages was thrown out of kilter. Mm-hmm. As you might imagine, some places where it would have been perhaps 500 volts, it might now go up to 1500 because of some component of the pack. Mm-hmm. Eventually, over the years, we replaced that with rectifiers and got rid of the rotating machines, and that had a bit of a history too. Was it those machines? In the post office, things that must be, well, in the Commonwealth Government Department, if they're not used for a certain time, they're returned to the store, and they stay down there for a while, and there's no movement on them, the store's bloke down there's like to say, right, put them up for public tender, and out they go. And that's what's happened to 5CK's 24-volt generators. The electroplaters were after these sort of things because they compound wound, and they had just the characteristics for electroplating. But make it worse, amongst some of the things there were two brand-new special compensated generators for one of these telephone exchanges, which wasn't yet built. It stayed down in stores for a while and then just got the same treatment, and some bloke bought them for peanuts, and then the department tried to buy them back from him. But they tried all sorts of legal and illegal ways, but he wouldn't budge. He had them and he was going to keep them.
What was the reluctance to rectifiers? Because they had rectifiers that wound them.
No, they didn't have them in those days, I would say.
Mercury vapour ones? For those sort of voltages?
Yeah, mercury vapour, did we have any? Mercury vapour, again, you've got other problems there, haven't you? You've got to heat something up to start then, do you?
Yes, you have to have them on for some minutes before they switch high tension. I'm just wondering whether there was a reluctance in the department towards those, or whether they were not reliable, or...?
I think it was probably that. I'm just trying to think now. We had mercury vapour down at Brookton Park, I think, in the last stages there.
Yes.
I've forgotten the types they were now. But you see, they...
872As, I think.
There was a bigger one.
Oh, that's right,
much,
yes. It was a
great bigger one.
Phillips.
Was it an 890?
DCG something.
892 or something.
Yes. And these would have been Phillips, I think.
Yeah.
That was another thing that the department did too. Like they found that STC, I think others too, were not making much money on their transmitters, but they were making a lot on the spares, especially the valves. and they let them a contract for the supply of the final valves at least, and the rectifier valves at Fosdy Cray and Brooklyn. And FDC jacked the price up a little, and to their surprise they didn't get the contract. And they were wondering why, and they were told, well, there are others about that they that were just as good and about half the price, which they wouldn't believe. They thought the department was bluffing, but the department didn't give them the contract, and they got it from Phillips. Now, Phillips had a line of valves which were very good, but they weren't exactly the same as these, and they didn't have the same output. But it was thought that they could do the same job, but they gave us no end of trouble. One of the most spectacular was that there was a ring inside there that used to separate the elements, and it would drop down sometime and join the grid to the plate or something equally spectacular. And the poor operator on duty, you know, having a quiet, nice time, bang, everything. And what's more, for a minute you couldn't find what had happened. You know, just everything had gone. And I think in the end it probably wasn't the best thing to do from a technical point of view, but it did bring down the price of the valves, which were a pretty big item in those days. Incidentally, during the war years, as the war went on, a lot of things happened. They put revetments around these buildings. Do you remember seeing?
Yes.
See, I had it and said CK.
That's right.
These were great big wooden structures. They'd be about 10 feet high, I suppose. Straight back and sloping, like a wall filling with sand. It cut out all the light in the building so that all day long now we have to have lights on. And they decided to, at Brooklyn Park, I can't remember CK, although I was interested in it then, but they decided that certain post offices, might have been all of them, but certainly Brooklyn Park, all the operators there had to be trained in the use of pistols. And they were going to be issued with a pistol, which would be kept under the desk, and that was there. So they took them in turn, each of the operators in turn, down to a pistol range somewhere, gave them pistol practice. I was strongly opposed to this because I reckoned if they were frightened of saboteurs and the saboteur came in the door, the fella on duty, if he pulled the pistol out, he had to be prepared to kill that bloke. Because saboteurs aren't there for fun, they're real.
Yes.
So you can't just pull out a pistol and say, hands up. You've got to pull it out and shoot him dead. And that was a terrible responsibility to put on to an operator.
Yes.
And for my money, I reckon that we should never have had them. But however, they issued them. And the fellas went down there. And, of course, some little time went by. And nobody, in all these tests, they didn't take the pistol from the station to do the test. Because a saboteur might come along while they're doing the test. So they trained them with proper pistols and everything else down there. And then suddenly as part of the scheme, they decided now that they send somebody around all these places, take all the pistols and make sure they're in working order, etc. And you'd be amazed, Brooklyn Park had ammunition that wouldn't fit in the pistol. Wouldn't have a hope of putting it in. And everywhere I went, practically, they found a sort of incompatibility. Oh, I think in the end that they came to the conclusion that I just mentioned, that this is not funny. If you're going to have a pistol down there, you've got to be prepared to shoot somebody stone dead. But that,
I think most of us had more faith in the kick switch underneath the table to knock out the filament supply.
Yes, but then again, these saboteurs are not as silly as they look. No. And if the switch is suddenly kicked out, they've got some idea that somebody has done it.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking back over it now, I just don't know. Like we had in some of the places too a special screw that you used to push in at a certain part into the control circuit, and without that nothing would start, and you had to go dive down into a floor duct to find this thing if you knew where it was. But fortunately we never had to. But on a couple of occasions at Brooklyn Park we were working all night, and there used to be a police patrol come around every, I think it was every night, used to include Rutland Park in its room. And they got to know the fellas there pretty well, but they didn't know me. And I'd be down there perhaps, you know, once a month or something, making some changes. And the night we were down there, and the police come in, we got all the transmitter pulled to pieces and the stuff lying out on the floor, and the policeman for a minute, none of the people on duty he knew, it was myself and somebody else who was with me, and a relief bloke, I think, there. And for a minute he got very, very firm and stern and wanted to know exactly what was going on, like with saboteurs at work.
Got a saboteur at last.
Yeah.
It wasn't funny at the time, sure.
Yeah. And you asked about examinations. When you joined the department, you could come on a temporary basis, but you could then sit for an entrance examination, which was fundamental English and maths, plus a technical exam now. And you got that knowledge by attending classes at the Postal Institute, or which Ford Runner used to run, or men like Frank O'Grady would run these classes for people. When the carrier systems came in, they called in a lot of the senior people who'd never had any contact with anything like this, and they ran through a course of the new carrier system principles and things, and then they didn't have to sit for an exam for that. But then to go further now, the engineer's examination, you have to now sit for a definite exam set by the Commonwealth Public Service for post office engineers. And that's the one that I sat for and qualified as an engineer. And that, in those days, that an engineer with an electrical engineering degree from the university, and particularly with a science degree, was not considered as good as an engineer who'd passed the departmental exam.
Well, they wouldn't have the practical.
That's right. And what's more, it was heavier stuff. You see, electrical engineering in those days was these big transmission lines and things like that. And it didn't get down to this fine stuff. Mm. But that did change after a while. And a lot of they had the trainee engineer course came along later on. And a lot of those now went on to get degrees. Some got science degrees, continuing with their departmental training from that.
And then a lot of them went into the BTEC, didn't they, when that started?
Yes, that's right. That was another application where they took a lot of very promising technicians, and I don't forgotten the basis on which they selected them, but they were selecting them. They got quite a lot of very good engineers from there.
Just coming back to a comment you made before about the measuring wavelength to allocate stations, I wonder if that was because as I recall, the old tuning capacitors in those days were made to linear wavelength. Is that the reason?
That's the reason for it, I think, yes. And I don't think they had any very accurate way of measuring frequency myself.
No, it's
we didn't have anything here at all until... From 1935, I think, 36, when Jack DeCure came over and they put in that thing at Somerton, the research had developed that there with the multivibrators and things for measuring frequency. That we had nothing reliable up until then to do it. And I think that was the reason. In 1936 at Brooklyn Park, this Messner thing had been turfed out. I made up self-excited Hartley oscillator, which was driving Brooklyn Park in those days, and we looked around now for crystal control, because CK had become crystal control, and Herb Brock down at the university, remember, he used to work in the science workshop or something near there, he was cutting crystals here, and we got one from him for Brooklyn Park,
730.
And it was rather a large thing, and we put this into a circuit there, but this was not as reliable as this Hartley, because it was an X cut, I think, Mm-hmm. And of course, we had no means then of controlling the temperature. Of it. And, you know, the variations were just too wide. So after, you know, about 3 months of that, we gave that away. But then we bought an STC crystal oscillator. Oh, this was a real champion.
Do you remember that one? Yes, yeah. That's right. It made in Spain, wasn't it?
Well, no, I don't know where it was made, but it had Spanish labels on all the controls of the meter, and that current was in Nautica Corriente or something, and the handbook was in English. There was no translation between the two, but you did wake up after a while. But that was a champion thing, and it went on for quite a lot of years. Until there was a special valve they had in there for some voltage regulating purposes, and that packed up, and we got into quite a bit of trouble. We couldn't get a replacement for it, and it wasn't any longer being made, but I've forgotten now how we got around that, but we did get around that in the end. But that was good. But before that, 5KA had bought a master oscillator. Now, I don't know which one, what make that was, but the radio monitoring group used to use that until we got our thing as their standard for the reference oscillator that they used in their measurements. But by that time, we were like frequency meters became, or frequency measuring devices became a bit more readily available.
I know that you're a fellow of the Institution of Radio and Electronics Engineers. When did you join the IEEE?
September 49.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I'd given a few talks to them, mostly on frequency modulation, because that was a pretty hot spot with me, and they'd been after, well, Don Gooding particularly, he was very keen on matters here, and asked me to join up, and that was the September 1949. Gee, it's a long while ago when you think back.
That was about the same year that Frank O'Grady joined.
Yes, in fact I think Frank had talked about it earlier and wasn't sure about it, and then he told me one day that he was joining up, and he said, well, I think about it, and well, I didn't.
Yeah, so you don't go back near the foundation days of the Institution, which is what I was wondering.
Well, it's funny, my father was an electrician, and in the Depression years, things were pretty tight, and he was out of work, actually. He's running his own little business, but he had a letter, I don't know, would have been Mink from Mingay, did he?
Ozzie Mingay,
Yes. I know it came around to all electrical contractors, and my father got one there, offering him foundation membership in the Institute of Radio Engineers. And I wasn't interested much in radio in those. So this would have been about 1927 or sometime. When did the...
Well, it started in 1932, didn't it?
Yeah. Somewhere in that area, yes. From 27. I know we'd come from living in the hills and we were down in the city, and somewhere in that period, I remember he showed it to me, and I wasn't interested and he wasn't. And otherwise, if I had a meal, but I wasn't, so that's it. Getting on to the frequency modulation, that was another activity that we had here. The first frequency modulated transmitter was at Mount Bonython. This was mono.
Yes. It was an experimental one that they had in all states, I think.
Yeah, well, what had happened, the Chifley government had decided that every state would have, every capital city would have a frequency modulated transmitter as an experiment. There's been pressure on them to do something, and they said, right, well, we'll put one on every capital city and see how it goes. Melbourne and Sydney got models that were built in the research section, I think, and we got a 250-watter from AWA, which its serial number was X1, which meant experimental one.
I've still got the nameplate, experimental one.
And we put that in up there, and I'd been impressed with frequency modulation from the Kingscote link, but before we put that in, we set it up in the laboratory, and went over the room, and we put programs through it, we took out the line filters from it, and it was amazing with clarity, and the dynamic range and the very low noise level of it. We never heard it. You see, we were struggling in those days at Brooklyn Park to get noise levels about 55 dB below the output level. But this thing here could come out about 70 dB in figures like this, and all so easily done. Overmodulation didn't mean anything as long as your bands would pass it. On a Brooklyn Park, if you overmodulate there, they're likely to trip the circuit breaker, something like that. So that when it was suggested we put it in here, of course, I was very enthusiastic over this, and it went in up there after some minor troubles to get it going. Obviously, what happened with that and the subsequent one we got, AWA had so much experimentation with it that the valve, final valves on there, which were 4125As, were tame. Now, when it came to put the new ones in, they were pretty lively now, and a lot of the circuit adjustments now were not quite right for it, and of course everything took off. But we put it in there on an experimental basis, running a program. In the beginning, we selected the program because there wasn't too much enthusiasm around the place for it. And incidentally, on that one, when we got this transmitter going here, research sent us over about a dozen receivers. One was a research FM-only model, or a really top-notch thing, big and bulky. Other one was an RCA AM-FM. And they're given around to various people, senior people in the department and that. And the Adelaide show was coming along. And if you've ever had to exhibit anything in the Adelaide show in the way of audio equipment or broadcasting equipment, the incidental noises down there is so bad that, you know, radio reception was pretty much possible. So we set this up with a FM receiver, an AM receiver, and big notice, this is FM. Notice no noise. This is the AM. Notice the noise.
Yeah.
It all's lovely. It's all working okay. And this was the afternoon before the opening, and I go home and pretty happy with it. And that night I got a call on the phone from Melbourne, and they said, "Hey, that show thing. Yeah, what about it? You have to take it out. Hey? To take it out. Oh, come on. No, it's come from PM himself. Oh," I said, "no." I said, "Yep, the big boys have got the work." See, at that time, the big three or four were thinking about TV, and they didn't want to be diverted their activities onto FM. They wanted to concentrate on TV. And apparently one of their representatives, or one of their companies here, represented them, must have told their head office, and the three of them must have got together and put onto the PM, and I was allowed to leave it in there, but with nothing else on it except to say FM, AM. That's all I could do. I couldn't make any...
Couldn't expand on its features.
Because you didn't have to. If anybody knew anything about it, they just get down there and listen. On the FM, you know, not a sign of these other noises on. But that went on there from 1948 to 1960, that closed down. But in the meantime... the government had changed, and they had decided that they were not going to go ahead with this FM. They were bowing to the pressure from the companies. The commercial broadcasting interests were opposing FM introduction unless they got an FM license as well as their AM license. And, you know, there was a lot of... political activity going on, and the then government decided no further expansion, so the West, Tasmania and Queensland didn't go ahead. But they sent the transmitter from Tasmania up to us here, so we went from 250 watts now to 3 kilowatts. lot more painful than that, though, going there, as it turned out. Because, again, this 3-kilowatt thing we got was an experimental one, too. Mm-hmm. And we had a heck of a lot of trouble with that one. The area was a halo, you remember? And condensation filled up with water.
Mm.
And having a ballon in there, you couldn't test anything past the ballon because you're just testing to earth and nothing. But when we pulled it down, it must have been about this time of the year when it went crook. We had to wait almost a spring before we could get the day to take it down and have a look at it. And all those halos were full of water. Not a leak, but just plain condensation in them, which you get a lot up in that mouth after the area. And they had giant jumbo banana plugs and sockets. Mm. Oh, stupid arrangement. And they had all corroded, and where they'd arced anywhere, of course, they'd corroded even further still. And that's when we got the pylon.
Yeah.
And that replaced that. And I don't know where the other one went to, but the pylon worked, except for birds getting in the early stages, and it worked very well there. But it was really good. We tried to find out. We had a number for listeners to contact to tell us about the FM reception. But in those days, you had to have a license for your second set, you remember?
That's right. Mm.
And we knew a lot of people were listening in. A lot of people at WRE and that were listening into this. But we couldn't get anybody to write in and tell us until one day we got a ring from one of these fellas and said, what do you take us for? We see this as a trap where we have to pay for a second license. Well, I couldn't give them any freedom from being fine if they were caught with a second set or anything. It was an awkward situation. But there was we got from Savory's, I think, a list of all people who'd bought radio equipment or combined equipment, and anybody, particularly those who had an FM attachment. So we had a list of something like about 40 or 50 people who bought the combined sets. Mm. But we still didn't know. We knew where they lived. They agreed to give us their names. We still didn't know whether they used it for FM or anything. But there was a fella up at Tarlee that we got on to. He was a farmer there, and he told the graphic story there that he liked classical music, and he listened to a particular session from 5CK, always for. But he said, whenever something good's on, it's a bad night now for reception from 5CK. And he said, on this particular night, he said, quite by mistake, he must have pressed the AM-FM button, which he didn't know what it meant, he said, at that time. And he said, all of a sudden, the room filled with this glorious sound, not a bit of noise or anything on it. Then he looked more closely at it and pressed it again. It must have been the tuning on the set must have just been right for those two modes. Yeah. Oh, and he was highly enthusiastic over that. And, that was about what we expected it might have done. But then they messed up, as you might remember. They took that band away.
Yes.
An international FM band was taken away, and then that set things back here for quite a number of years.
Eventually it came back again, didn't it?
Yes, well, it would have to, wouldn't it? It couldn't stay like that. But in the meantime, did they have a TV station in there? I think they did, didn't they?
Yes, GDS4 started.
Yeah.
And I had to keep it off whenever GDS4 were on. Yeah. But I kept niggling it on at times.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even although I was reprimanded by you several times.
Oh, yeah, we wouldn't take much notice.
No, I think I had the standard reply. I had to keep it checked to know that it was working.
The first... now, that's covered the three stations in South Australia, didn't it? Yeah. The first station in Darwin, at 5DR, it was 5DR then, was an army amenity station, which the post office put in for the army in 1944. I went up there with the army people and selected two sites for it. They were two Army TASMAs, I think, TASMA equipment that was been supplied to the Air Force, and they'd been modified for amenities work in the islands and that.
Yes.
And the Army supplied the Sydney Williams huts, and we had one of them out at Leanya Swamp, out on the Lee Point Road, and we had a square mile of land, I think, out there. And the transmitter was at Cemetery Plains. And the call of 5DR was allocated to Darwin and 5AL to Adelaide River. And we put in half of Adelaide River. We finished Darwin as an amenity station and handed over to the Army. And then they ran it then with, mostly I think, with those great big long playing American CBS records, mostly American programs, like I say. But Adelaide River, we started on that installation. There were two 100-foot wooden guide masts with a flat-top aerial and a transmission line. Incidentally, that was the... that the first use, or do we use it AN? I think AN was the first use of the four-wire transmission lines like Jack Ross used down at Pimpala eventually. The first one was AN when we moved that down to Brooklyn Park. It was the first transmission line when we raised up 5CL and fed it at the bottom of the era. 5AN at Brooklyn Park had a solid coaxial cable feed. But we used this five-wire line, actually six wires I think we used in the end, but the four around the outside as a shield. And that was used at 5DR and 5AL. With the 5AL we got the masts up, we got the transmission in, the hut I think was erected when the war changed and they cancelled 5AL. And eventually that call sign was used down at Alice Springs was 8AL today. And then in 1946 I went up with Charles Wicks, the manager of the ABC here. And by the way, we had some very good liaison with some of the managers of the ABC. Some of them were not so good, but there were some very, very good ones there. Charles Wicks was one. Jim Miller was another. And earlier was Colonel, what was his name? I think he was the second manager here. Well, it might come back in a minute. I didn't have much contact. Frank O'Grady had all the contact in those days. But Charles Wicks and I looked at Darwin to see if they'd established the thing on a civilian basis. It was agreed we would, so we took these huts, these Sydney William huts, into a site. And that was a problem. Looking for a site up there then was a very difficult job. The administrator was a sort of a temporary fellow. This was in 46, or just 45, probably just after the war, and not really able to make too many firm decisions of allocating land and things. And we wanted something pretty definite. We didn't want to be putting it somewhere where we'd be moving it next week. But in the lands department, there was a very helpful draftsman in there. He said to me one day, look, there's an area of land that was gazetted in 1896 or 1904 or something. He said, for wireless purposes. He said, what's wrong with that for you? He said, if it's suitable, he said, I strike of a pen and it's yours, because he said it doesn't have to go through any process at all. So we went and had a look at it, and that was at just above the Botanic Gardens. It had been used during the war for a naval supply depot, and they'd cast a long concrete slab on the block. All their buildings had gone there, and very nice. Okay, we put our name on it and brought in these huts and joined them all together. They sat on the concrete slab. We didn't have to do much work there. And we brought in the two 100-foot masts and re-established it all there. And off we went. And On the opening night, I went up with Charles Wicks, and I forget his Christian name, but McDonald, who was the chief engineer of AWA in those days, he was up there too, because they were looking for a new site for their coastal station up there. They were up Alligator Creek or somewhere, and no, that's not his name, but the alligators, they used to be able to see them from the back door of the building, and they were looking for a much better site. In those days, they went for somewhere with the longer waves that they were using, where there was plenty of water for their earthing system, but that meant up there also alligators. And he came around looking for it, but this site that we got apparently was one originally intended for coastal radio purposes, and it should have been theirs. But he was very nice about it. He gave us the hint. Well, on the opening night, we'd made transmissions and tests and things beforehand, and it was giving pretty good coverage. There were two sets. There was one in use and a standby. They were 200 watts, I think. 2 kilowatts, something like that. And on the opening night, the speeches are being made, and I had to read a couple from departmental people who couldn't get them there. Those days we didn't have a landline through to Darwin, so they couldn't do it over the landline. And while I'm reading these speeches, I can see agitated signs from the control room window there, and I'm looking around, I can't make out what's going on, but as soon as I'm finished, it's a stinking hot night, by the way, and I went into the room, and they said, look, we're inundated with calls, the power's dropping off. We have a look around, the RF power is there, okay, so it's happened to be audio. And so we pulled all the blinds down and left the phone off the hook, but the output, apparently we made some tests, listening to it, you can hardly hear it towards, just before close down. I'd say that nobody really heard the closing announcement, and they'd swept over in the meantime to the standby and exactly the same. So off went our church, and this fellow McDonald came in too, and he rolled up his sleeves, and we're trying to find this thing. And they had negative feedback in those days from the final tubes of the modulator right back to the cathode or the grid of the first input stage, and it was a DC feedback, and there was a fairly high resistor in the feedback path, and this was gradually going higher and higher and higher and cutting off the audio. And exactly the same fault was on the two transmitters, the one in use and the one It took us a little while, I should say, took us nearly a couple of hours. Of course, there's high voltage around there, you can't be doing too much. But I can still think of it now, your sleeves roll up, you've got a pair of pliers, and half a litre of water slops off the end of the pliers, and you shake your hand and put it in again, and a couple of minutes later, the perspiration was running down. Oh, it was some night.
You wouldn't have been used to resistors going high in those days either. It would be a fairly new experience for most people, wouldn't it? Resistors going so changing like that.
I suppose these would be a carbon composition, these. But we used to have a bit of this in the condenser microphones. You see, they fit a potential there through a resistor, and they were a carbon track, something like the old grid leak resistors, you remember?
Yeah, that'd be very high value, high ohmic value too, wouldn't it?
Yes. Well, now, some of those used to go gradually very high and then go open circuit originally. And this is, in fact, these at the end, these resistors in this Darwin case did just that. And it meant then that the bias that you'd put on in the earlier stages, the count of this DC that was coming back was just cutting the stage right off.
Well, are there any other final areas that you'd like to make a few comments on, or any funny anecdotes?
There are two catastrophes that happened in my time there. One was electrocution of a technician at 5CK, and that was a terrible thing. He was a young lad, a very promising young lad, keen, and just the sort of chap that would do well in the department. He'd been recently married, and they were changing over the transmitter. The alterations they were making, they had roped off the active section of the working transmitter, and the new transmitter where they were working was quite free. But in those days, the high voltage bus bars, and they were about 10 or 12,000 volts DC, were up above normal height. They'd be about seven feet, perhaps a little higher above ground level, and they were normally reckoned on being quite safe because of, you know, nobody, you couldn't touch them with your hand anyhow, was beyond that. And but this keen young fella came on duty, and he came round the back of the transmitter where they were working, and for some reason that nobody knows, he stepped on a stool and stood up in the air and said, "Can I help you?" And that's the end of him. His head touched the 10,000 volts, and that was the end of him. And I tell you what, when you're in charge of a thing like that, you're a very lonely bloke for a long while. Yeah. Everybody is looking now to make sure they don't get involved in anything at all. But I did have some support. Frank O'Grady by then was back in Melbourne, and our central office people there really supported it. It was the first electrocution, I think, in the apartment. But when we had been putting in that second range of RACO, was it, equipment for DCA? You remember that, where they had the combined equipment, they had the low frequency on one side and the high on the other?
That's right.
Common modulator, and you opened a door to change things. When you opened the door, you pulled out blades from what was really a knife switch, so that this panel was now dead. But back in the cabinets, in Queensland, a DCA chap on an installation, which I think the post office might have put in for DCA, but that was nothing to do with it. He, for some reason, went in there, inside it, where he should have stood outside, knelt down to do some work on the thing and sat on these things. Mm. So the central office, it relied a good deal there on the fact that all these years we'd been operating these high voltage transmitters and things, that this was the first case they had of a fatality, really. And the other thing, incidentally, on that one, it was very, very sad. He was he just had his first family. He'd had a fortnight to go to the end of his probationary period, where he would have been qualified now for superannuation, and or his widow would have been, and everything else. They did their best to see what they could do, but they just couldn't do it. You know, a fortnight, they couldn't stretch them. But he had succumbed to the blandishments of an insurance salesman had come around for a £10,000 insurance policy, which was a lot of money in those days. And he'd just initialled the proposal form, but the insurance company honoured it. It was really good, but they did it on the basis that they paid his widow three annual payments of $3,500 or something on it. But that was the only bright spot in there. It was a very sad thing. The other one was the collapse of the Mount Burr television mast. That was just before Christmas, and we had the commercial stations aerial up the top. We hadn't put ours on it yet. And Brian Hammond was the engineer in charge down there, and I'd been expecting him to ring any time and say, you know, she's all okay now, because we were making arrangements for the opening. And Frank O'Grady was getting near the end of his time in December, which wasn't very far away, and he was coming down for the opening there. And Brian rang up about midday and he said, oh, he said, the mast has fallen down. And of course, again, I thought, oh, yeah, we'll put it back again. And he said, what in the bees easy is that? I said, well, what happened? And there were two methods in those days of tensioning guy wires. You know, those big guy wires on these things, they get a certain twist in them. Mm. And if you curl them around in coils and straighten them out, it takes a while for that twist to go out. And there were two school of thoughts. There was, I think, EPT. EPT pre-tensioned them in their factory. Johns and Waygood, who supplied that one down there, tensioned them on their job. Their argument was if you put them on a truck or something and carted them down there, they were twisted again and some of this tensioning would change. And in any case, when you've got a mast that high, what was that, 700 feet or something, wasn't it? When you've got a mast that high, the top guys are very long and you've got to have a pretty big area now to pre-tension these guys on the ground, and you've got to have a couple of bulwarks to anchor them to. Mm. They've got to be pretty strong, because but they tension them to about, what is it, 3 or 4 times their working figure, and it's, you know, there's a lot of strain on that. And anyhow, Johns and Waygood's tensioned them on the job. And it was while they were doing their tensioning test, this is the over-tensioning up to this room, that a guy anchor failed. And it looked like two failed, but of course one, in those circumstances, you never know which comes first. One only got the gun and that's it. And the mast came down, it folded actually, looking as if the bottom anchors must have held for a while. It folded, right on itself, the bottom and the top were together, parallel, with a big bend in the middle, and the wire, the hawser, ran over the wing of a ute that was there and ripped that off, went right over the top of the emergency power building where 3 or 4 people were working in there, ripped all the roof off there, but nobody was hurt, miraculously. And it was one of those, there was a big inquiry over this, and a lot of trips to Melbourne, insurance people were involved in this as well. It wasn't really a departmental problem because it hadn't been handed over to us. Although we were there observing it, Johns and Waygood was still erecting it in the
first time under their control.
Under their control. Mm. And it was established that it was one of these strain age embrittlement things where the holes in the end of the anchor things just pulled out. Now, they checked this over, they measured the distance between the hole and the edge of the metal. They reckoned that could have been better. They had a look at a lot of things there, but in the end they found out this, that when they made these anchor plates, they used 3 methods to prepare them because they were busy and trying to do a lot of things at once. The power hacksaws that were cutting them off, they were all busy, so they sheared some of them with a shear, and the others they blew off with a torch. Now, it's the ones that were sheared, they reckon gave the trouble, because the power hacksaw didn't do anything to it. It didn't stress anything at all, and they reckoned that the ones they burnt off didn't, but the other one, now where they sheared it, now they set up stress in it which was not relieved. And that was a sad thing, that the most of the workers there were seemed to be Italians or Greeks or something, and they're all happy and they're home for Christmas. This is about a fortnight before Christmas, or 3 weeks or something. And then there it is, lying on the ground, and the only thing that we would agree to reusing was the tabernacle sat on. The rest of it was just
got metal.
But that they were the two. I suppose it's what you might call catastrophes in my life with these things.
Well, I haven't got any other points here. No, there's anything that you had in mind that we might cover that we haven't spoken about? Or?
I was wondering if might be worth a mention of the some of the STC tubes that were used, or Western Electric tubes, used in some of the early carrier systems.
The first ones that I knew about were in the Type B telegraph and the Type B telephone systems to Melbourne from Adelaide. They used, I think these were STC, they had a 4 in front of them, didn't they? The 4102, 4101, 4102, and they were mostly those, and there was the 4104, wasn't it?
Yes. That was the high gain tube, I think.
That was a power tube, I think, that one. Was that right? Was the 102 the high? 102 used to be the one that used to be microphonic, as I was explaining later on. Yeah. But they were spherical size things with a little tip on the thing that you could knock off pretty easily. They were really, you know, the classical basic vacuum tube, weren't they, or valve. And in the system where we had them, in those days, somebody was going around about every half hour, every hour, and reading a number of things on these tubes. You'd read the filament volts for a start. Filament current, I think, was the important thing then. You'd measure that. You measured the bias that was on them. I think you measured the plate volt. And they entered this in the book. And you made a test on them for their filament activity. I've forgotten how often this was made, but this was part of the thing whereby you'd vary the filament voltage, filament current over a range, and look at the plate current. And that was the position for quite some time. The first speech input equipment we bought or got made up was a 1 for 5 CK, and that had 101s, 102s. I think that one might have had a 205 in the output. That had the others all worked off 130 volts, but the 205 had 100. I think that could take 200 odd volts on it. And I think it's the 102 in this chain. There were three or four valves in it. That had a lead cap over it for microphonicity problems, and it was highly microphonic. And the controls, there were two volume controls on it. I don't quite know now why we had two. It must have been an early stage where you control in a later stage. I remember it used to sit there with two hands. They were a great big long Bakelite knobs about this long.
That's just long.
Yes, I still don't know why they were like that. Mm. But that was the original thing there. And then we bought one of those for the 5CL studios before we made that big change in 1935 when we made the change over to the new equipment there. The Melbourne telephone system, the three-channel telephone system, it was single sideband but transmitted carrier. Mm-hmm. And the Adelaide girl would signal the Melbourne girl by cutting the carrier, and that would drop a shutter. But of course, every time there was a line break or any fault in the thing, the girl at Melbourne would be getting a continuous ring until somebody jacked the thing out. Well, we modified those. Rick and Grady had they modified pretty quickly, and we cut the carrier out. We didn't transmit the carrier, but this brings other problems, because often the carrier from this end is used to synchronise the oscillator at the other end. But by that time, oscillators were getting a little more stable. And there's one thing, I suppose, with equipment like that, it's on all the time. you know, you don't switch it off and then it goes through a heating up theory. Generally speaking, it's on the whole time. The other interesting area that I had some to do, the transmission section in those days did all these things. You'd be working one time perhaps at the broadcasting, another time on something else, and again on real transmission work, was voice frequency dialing. Frank O'Grady developed that here in 1936, and the first one was put in at Clear. That was a system. Again, I suppose it might have been some financial strictures, but some of the other states had that 2VF system that you hear of later on. But we didn't get that here, but Frank developed this system here, and the first one was at Clear, which allowed the country telephonist now to dial straight into the network. They didn't have to go. But the telecom people weren't keen on this, because this took the control of the line out of their hands. The country girl now, they thought, would be ringing Melbourne and Sydney and other places, and they wouldn't have any control. But eventually they came around. But that was an area that Frank O'Grady had developed to a pretty high degree here. Voice frequency dialing. In my career in the department, I found it in transmission. It was a very, very interesting job. Always, like, there was the carrier systems that came in, and then we took on broadcasting, and then we became the technical people here for DCA. And for 10 years we did all their major installations and a lot of their maintenance and the removal of some of their installations and their acceptance testings and things like that. And that went on. We handed that over, and then we had the FM that came along, and then we broadcast the schools, which eventually John Allen took over from us. But we set a standard for broadcast receivers for education department schools, and we used to do a checking of all applications for public address and receivers and things for any school had to be approved by a departmental way. And then a little later again, when Broadcasting Control Board was established, we became their technical representatives here too, and we used to do the inspections and checks on their on the local commercial stations for them. And also we would do special tests if they wanted them done in connection with site selections and of things of that nature.
Yes, there's a good variety of
yes, as I say, there's always something interesting coming along. And
what about TV? Was that during your time?
Yes, that was in my time, and that came along more about 1960 or something, I think. 59. Yeah, 59 was it. Well, the site at Mount Lofty was originally chosen for the Kangaroo Island radio telephone.
Yes.
And that had some interesting things too. I think you've mentioned some aspects of this. When the security people were worried about the finding a few mines off the south coast of Kangaroo Island, they asked now for better communication for the island. And the island had a submarine cable with four wires in it from Cape Jervis across the Cuttlefish Bay. And they also had a standby radio set. That's an interesting one. That was a Ford smart coil. And that wasn't under our control. But we made up for them a beautiful valve transmitter, clean and neat, a beautiful signal. But then bloke in charge of that area said, no, it's too narrow. Yeah, like we want something that's broad that they can listen to.
Yeah, they'll hear it if it works. Yeah.
But the cable across from Cape Jervis was never good. When it came here, it was put into the wrong bay. the bit of an argument between the lines bloke here and the captain of the cable laying ship, and he went into the wrong bay, and he was about a quarter or half a mile short of cable, and they had to buoy up there for about 3 months, 6 months, until they got another section out from England. I don't know, but I think that's probably where this one wire became damaged, and it meant now instead of having two metallic pairs with a phantom over them, and then a Kylo over that, and then again they had a ghost circuit over that again. You could never get it really to work properly, and partly because that the security people asked about this radio telephone link, and originally that was going to go from Cape Jervis to Penashore, and Central Office sent over some sets that had been used for outside broadcast. Mm. They were self-excited. Was it 19s? A valve, that was a double triad, wasn't it, 19? I think they were 19s or a valve like that. It fed straight out into the aerial. Oh, boy. We took them down to the jetties at Grange and Henley, and we couldn't talk between the two jetties with them. Jeez. And we were cutting out, and of course at Cape Jervis in those days there was no power down there at all of any sort. Mm. And when it got to Penashore was 30 miles from Kingscote, and the line down to Cape Jervis was about 50 miles, some of the worst, roughest, storm-ridden country in the world. And I would say in the winter, the pretty well every day along when I was going down there. And I liked the idea of coming as close as we could to Adelaide. They looked at Wollonga Hill for a while, but I liked this Mount Lofty one the best here. And finally, that was agreed to. And it's the quickest acquisition I've ever seen. The war was on. It was 1941 when this started. The war was on. And the army hirings, of course, they're the people who'd pressured us to do something for them. They just marched in and said that Mrs. O'Leary, that's right, O'Leary, just said to her, look, we're going to take it, and that's that. And she was very cross about that. We had it within about a month, I think, we had the thing. Mm. And then later on, of course, they just transferred it to us. But she'd been used to going overseas every year, or more than once a year, on trips. And the war had stopped all that. And she was very, very hostile about it. And one day I was up there, and what had happened? Oh, yes, we were erecting those big arrays. They were 39 meg arrays then, and we'd brought up an explosive expert from one of the line sections, and he'd got foxed a little bit. When they drilled the hole down through the rock, he'd gone too far and gone underneath the rock shelf, and he thought it was rocky when he needed a big charge. He put it on the course, he blew a cavern underneath it, and just at that precise moment, the water supply to Mrs. O'Leary got cut off. Nothing whatever to do with this. And I arrive up there, and that time there's a lot more growth on the place than this, and that side of the bush, she came up and bailed me up. And she was very, very cross about this. And I said, if it's anything to do with us, we'll fix it, don't worry about it. But she, and then she opened a bag and pulled out a pistol, a little pistol. She didn't aim it at me, but she said, look, I know how to take care of myself, and if I'm threatened, she said, I'll use this. Then the boys in Central Office called her Pistol Packing Mama. Yeah. Remember that song that was around it? But we got that land there without much difficulty at all, very little trouble, and of course it was very handy when the TV came along. We had the site there. Yeah. And Mount Bonython, we had two good blokes here. Henry Sansom was in effect the chief engineer, and he was all for radio. And Frank O'Grady, of course, as I've said, he gave it his full support. And we also took Mount Bonython. And that was a bit of a fight, because old Langdon Bonython had it changed. It was always called a little mount when I worked them up this way. But then because about the time when he did something to help the government, they changed it to Mount Penython. Mm. And his son Lavington was very hostile to the acquisition of it. But anyhow, we got those two, which in the turn of events was probably just as well. Mm. Yeah. Well, that's been a long talk, will you?
Thanks very much, Ted. That's been really good. I think we've got a bit of information there, a bit of history, quite a lot of history, actually. Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, thanks. Use it if we wish.
Well, Radio Australia came about because I don't know who, I suppose the government or somebody, interested in getting the Australian point of view up to the nearer islands, and including Indonesia and perhaps part of China and that, and they couldn't do it from Shepparton because it was a second hop for them, but from Darwin this was going to be the spot for it. And, it's on, and we go up there and we select a beautiful site. We wanted a square mile for each of the places, and we had a nice site down there towards Howard Springs, which was a bit of a pleasure resort there. And we'd selected this. I went to see the army. I went to tell all the authorities what we were doing about it, and went to tell the army, and the major there startled a little bit and didn't say anything, but we came back to town, and then we found out now that we couldn't have it. That the army had wanted this for some special purposes, and now we had to start looking now for other sites. And now everybody, there was special hearing up in Darwin on this. This was something like this Pimpala thing. It dragged on and on. Instead of it being settled in about a year or two, it must have gone on for 5 or 6 years. And everybody ganged up on the post office. Now DCA said, no, we can't have anything like this near us. The army didn't want us in a certain spot. The Air Force didn't want us in a certain spot. This is when we got kicked over to Cox's Peninsula, which is right across the harbour, 4 or 5 miles by sea, 90 miles by road, and the road's cut for 3 or 4 months every year by the floods and things there. And it was a terrible decision, but Jack Ross took it on from there and established it there finally. And I never saw it going. I'd retired before it got going, and I went to America and overseas to Italy and Portugal to look at similar installations to see how things might fit into what we were doing here. But it had more vagaries, because each time it was changed the price went up. And they have to go back again now to the Special Finance Committee of the Parliament and chop this off and chop that off, and you know, you'd lose the standby power plant or it'd be reduced to something else. And, Jack had a pretty tough time with that one, but eventually it got on the air, I believe, but of course Tracy wiped a lot of that out. But the Jack Ross designed the, with the help of the local harbour master, designed the launch that they used to take the chaps to work with. And that was another thing. We had to take them with buses down to the wharf, then take them over the harbour in the launch, then take them with buses to the transmitting and the receiving station. See, some of those fellows would be away for over nearly 12 hours from when they left their home until they got back again after a shift. It was a very, very tedious,
That had a big log periodic area up there, didn't it?
Yes, that's the one I went over to Italy to have a look at there, and it didn't turn out to be satisfactory in the end, but I feel like this, that somebody in the industry or has got to try things out.
Yes.
Otherwise, the art doesn't progress at all. And log periodics, they had this big advantage, the log periodic. For these sorts of broadcasting installations, you have to change frequency and you have to swing the aerial a certain direction. The log periodic was supposed to let you do this without having a serious effect on the feed impedance. Now, with the other arrays, it was then thought to be a good, these panel arrays thought to be harder to do that, and you'd either want more arrays or some other arrangements. And the people who had the contract for this was a crowd in Italy called Coel, and they that had developed this system pretty well, so we'd been told. But I think in the end they went back, in the new installation, they went back to the panel arrays.
Did they?
Yeah. Yes, and they, I think they knew a bit more about them than from the experiences at Shepparton. But in the meantime, because we are dawdling so much here, our local administration, by the way, weren't very helpful on this. I was out of it by then, but they were not very, they didn't give it a lot of encouragement. And they put one in Western Australia?
Yeah.
Where was it? Somewhere up the coast, wasn't it?
Geraldton, wasn't it?
Geraldton, yes. But that's it proved the point. They still have to have Darwin to cover this area, because Geraldton was so far south that it apparently wouldn't do what they wanted with it. But that was a very big installation, that Darwin one. I think a lot of this improved, by the way. The fortunes, a lot of radio stuff improved when they broke away from the PMG, as it were, telecom. Mm-hmm. You remember they formed a new radio group in central office, which is concerned with broadcasting and television.
That's right.
Well, from then on, I think that the fortunes changed a lot. Jack Ross became the state manager here. They seemed to have enough money to do the things they wanted to do in a proper manner, and I think that was a very good thing for them, as it turned out. Because in the post office for many years, even from the very earliest days, there was a strong core of telephone-oriented people, especially in the lines section, who wanted nothing to do with broadcasting or any of these other fantastic things at all. They reckoned that was not telephone work. And over the years, been a few attempts to hand back or hand over to somebody the broadcasting activity. And that finally happened, of course, when the television studios were run by ABC staff. We didn't come into that. We did the transmitters. We didn't do the studio. The question was asked, well, if the ABC staff can run effectively the television studios, why shouldn't they be able to run the broadcast studio? Well, there was a lot of argument over that one. And finally, the minister said, well, if my officers can satisfy me that the personnel who are going to run it is acceptable to them to maintain the service, he was anxious to see no change in the quality of the service. It had to be as good as it was with the PMB before he handed over to anybody else. He said, well, he would seriously consider it. Well, Frank O'Grady by that time was the Director General. And they offered the job to Horry Hyatt, who was then the Central Office radio man. Very, very, very good chap. But he was close to retirement and he didn't want to go in and take over the establishment of a thing like this. And Vern Kinnear was offered to Vern Kinnear, but he wasn't interested in it. They called applications for it, and they got quite a number of overseas applications for this job. Now, this fellow who got it had to be approved by the PMG. Otherwise, it wouldn't go ahead. They sounded out Vern Kinnear again, and he said he wasn't interested. And I got a ring, and I was told to put in for it. Now, I didn't want it at all. I wasn't interested in it. Because I knew a bit of what was going on with the ABC, and in a new organisation, when you come in from an established organisation where there are a lot of people who are experienced with administration and know how a system works, and you go into a new system now, and everybody's coming in from somewhere else, a lot of them never having had a lot of administrative experience, you get a pretty rough ride in it.
Yeah, particularly when they didn't want you there.
Yes, that's right. And so anyhow, their interviews were called, and at the last moment, Vern Kinnear decided to put in for it. And that pleased me a lot, because I couldn't see anybody beating him. Well, in the end, that's the way it turned out. But it was a strange thing at the interview. You were interviewed by the whole commission. At the interview, I think old Charles Moses was there, didn't that's right? The question was asked, this was a strange, how would you consider Mr. Kinnear for this job? Oh, I could only say one thing, couldn't I? I really mean it, because I said, well, to me, maybe without knowing any of these overseas people, of those I know, he'd be the outstanding applicant. And he got it in the end.
And yet they asked you that question when you were being interviewed for it.
Yeah, being interviewed for it. I don't know whether they thought I might have run him down or something like that and said he wouldn't be as good as what I am. But as soon as they asked me, that was a big relief for me, because quite frankly, it would have meant going to Sydney. But the point is, rather the department had asked me to put in for it, was that Horry Hyatt would have been the top choice. Vern Kinnear would have been. Now, either of those two, the department would have fully supported and would have been able to say to the minister, right, well, we fully agree. Well, the next choice down the line, in seniority, I suppose, was myself. And again, they would have been, I suppose, prepared to have said, okay. Well, once Vern Kinnear put in for it, and the department said yes, okay, well, the whole thing then went ahead. But there's a lot of strife that occurs in the changeover like that. Yes. You've got senior people in our organisation now, could be junior to some of the people who've just started with ABC, because they've been there they couldn't take their seniority with them, could they?
No.
They could take their long service leave and their superannuation and their status. But they couldn't take their seniority with them. And I don't know. I haven't spoken to a lot of them. Bill Walker went over, didn't he?
Yes.
Was he happy there?
Yes, I reckon he was always happy.
Yes. See, Jack Ribble had to make some tough decisions then, too.
Yes.
And our department said to them, too, well, if you don't go over there, we can't guarantee that forever you'll retain your present status in the department, because we've got nowhere to put you. So it was not so.
We developed a new meaning for the initials ABC.
What was
all
that?
Bloody confusion.
Yes,
it seems to have settled down now, though, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it has.
Well, look, DCA was like that. When DCA sort of, I think all states helped DCA. I know Queensland, Vern Kinnear in Queensland was like I was here. He did a lot of work with him. And when they formed their own organisation, they had people coming in from everywhere, from AWA, SDC, and getting some of their top jobs. They had very good academic qualifications, a lot of them, but they hadn't had very much practical experience and very little administrative experience. And from my contact with them about that time of the changeover, there was one heck of a lot of confusion again there. And I reckon it'd take 10 or 15 years to really settle down and establish it. And you see, not many people are used to working with an organisation where your funds are determined by the government. it's changed a little today with these corporations and things, but back in the days when I was interested in these things, there was a Commonwealth government vote for broadcasting, and you had to work within that, and that couldn't be touched by any other part of the PMD's department. They couldn't take a bit of that and use it for lines or something else. It had to also be spent on it. And for people who are not used to these administrative processes, and another thing is often forgotten too, that the budget's an act of Parliament. Once the budget's passed, that can't be altered in theory, unless Parliament again passes another act of Parliament to change it, and that's very rarely done. But Treasury and the finance people in the various departments, they can wangle things around. They've got to be able to do that. But actually, it is an act of Parliament. That's, when the budget's passed, that's an act of Parliament for 12 months, and that's all. You can't get funds for any longer.
Yes, for people who have been used to private enterprise and putting up a case and saying, we've got to have this and getting funds.
And when you can say, well, I'm not going to spend $20,000 this year, we'll put that in the hot for next year. You can't do that with this because Parliament has said that's what you've got to spend this year. And this is why with government departments, round about, March, you get frantic rings from central office. Look, can you spend $100,000? Look, you can buy test equipment, but look, it must be paid for before the end of June.
Been through that, because I work with the state government and we had the same problems. Well, you always put a mark on the calendar which day it would happen.
And what's more, the budget is considered where? About August or something, is it? Yeah. And it's usually not until late October that it's actually passed. Yeah. So in theory, you can't spend any money then. And now you've got to spend this before the next end of June. And somebody comes along and disrupts your program and say, look, here's another 100,000. Or worse, we want 200,000 from you because they're short in Queensland or something. And it's this is not generally understood, I think, by the public, how these things
doesn't
work.
Leave you very long to operate normally, actually, does it? Because you don't get your money till October or so, and then you've got to spend it by March, so it can be paid for by June.
Yes, that's
and,
right.
And the Christmas period's in there. Yeah. And
But like all human beings, you adapt to it, don't you?
Yes.
You find ways around it. And the firms now, if you look Packard, if you want to buy half a dozen expensive things there, a lot of those firms have got ways of quickening things, giving you a receipt for it, whether you haven't actually received.
Yeah, that's right. Whether you
got the thing. Yeah, yeah. But apart from that, it's you survive.
Yeah. Well, my friend, it's getting dark. We're difficulty finding our way home.
Goodness me.
Yeah, quarter past.